and a close watch would give us the opportunity to find him.
We will do better than that, Neferata said. We will make them take us to him.
That would be ideal. Following them will be difficult, though. They will all be on their guard.
Indeed, they will be. If they are wise, they are terrified. I can use their terror.
Neferata smiled, anticipating the game ahead. She would teach Vasque and his allies what vengeance really meant. The retribution would give her great pleasure. So would the process. They were both facets of her art. She took great pride in the aesthetics of violence. The noise of the revel grew louder, and when Neferata and Merineth finally reached the great hall, there was a new and greater crescendo. A wave of sound greeted Neferata, rising high and foaming with shouted praise. Mortal and vampire nobles rushed forwards, crowding each other in the effort to be the most visible in congratulating the conquering queen. Neferata gave the multitude her coldest smile and walked slowly through their midst, down the centre of the great hall. She passed beneath the great chandelier of bone and volcanic glass. Its wraith light blazed at her approach, the candles of human tallow burning more brightly at her mere presence, as if the light were hungry and had sensed it would be fed more souls. The hall danced with the shifting play of eldritch light and shadow, the two mixing in a liquid dance, revealing and concealing the faces of the celebrants.
If any of them imagine they can hide in the dark, they will be disappointed. The darkness belonged to Neferata. It obeyed her and no one else.
As she mounted the dais in the centre of the hall, someone shouted, "All hail Queen Neferata! All hail the Mortarch of Blood!" The crowd answered,
"Glory to Nelamia!"
from another noble.
"Glory to Neferata!"
from all. In the gallery above the rear of the hall, the court musicians struck up a thunderous fanfare. It drowned out the shouts of the crowd and drew the nobles to attention. When it ended, the revelers were quiet. They stood still, looking at Neferata expectantly. She wondered how many were fearful. She knew better than to trust any of them. They could all be traitors, given the right circumstances. The question was, which members of her court had already found those circumstances?
"You are all welcome to this celebration," she told the multitude. "Though the war against Angaria has barely begun, still we have hurt the foe most grievously. We have earned our revels. Turn to them now. Let us feast and dance and drink to the triumph of the present and to victory of the future."
The nobles began to turn to each other again, sensing that the formalities were over. The orchestra sounded a chord, and the crowd at the centre of the hall parted to either side, opening up the space for dancers. Neferata held up a finger, silencing the musicians, freezing the movement of the court.
"There are those among us who do not celebrate," she said. "They wear the masks of joy. They shout with as much enthusiasm as anyone else, but this is not a moment of triumph for them. It is a defeat, one they will not accept lightly. Already they plot anew, but they have lost the element of surprise. I know they are here. My vengeance comes for them."
She paused and looked over the heads of the nobles to the towering iron doors of the hall. The doors opened, admitting Scarveth and his black knights. They were fully armed, and they had drawn their swords. The doors closed behind them, and they formed a line of forbidding martial death. The shadows rushed to gather around them. Already the work had been done on their armour to mark it with Neferata's heraldry, and the skeleton warriors stood with menacing pride. The air of the grave haunted their plate and shields like a kind of mouldering cold, visible as hair-thin, wavering tendrils of darkness rising from the night. At the same time, the metal gleamed with burnished gloom, its decay transmuted into strength. "Behold, the heroes of the hour," said Neferata. "Their loyalty and their sacrifice turned the tide against the foe. They have shed the taint of their treacherous house. They are now the riders of Nell." Neferata paused, letting the eyes of the assembly shift uneasily back and forth between her and the Black Knight. She turned slowly, facing the entire hall, letting every soul, living and dead, feel the weight of her gaze. As she moved, she spoke again, softly now. Her voice reached through the silence like a striking serpent. "I address myself now to the traitors. I am magnanimous, and I present to you a gift. It is the gift of a warning. I could let you believe that you are safe, that you are hidden, that I do not even know of your existence. I could do this. Instead, I tell you now, you are not safe. House Lytessian is no more, and the flames of its pyre scour the shadows which you believe conceal you. You hide, but we will see you. You are silent, but we will hear you." She completed her turn and paused once more. She presented the nobles with a different smile. It was still cold. It was also hungry. It was the grin of a supreme predator. She gestured to the riders of Nell. "They will hear you." As the night progressed, Nagia Thresend enjoyed the victory ball less and less. It had begun well. She had moved through the revelers with confidence, secure in her position. She had danced enthusiastically before Neferata's arrival. She had cheered and shouted with everyone else. She had done well. She had been certain her secrets were safe and that she was the one on the offensive. Nagia was the youngest of the heirs to House Thresend. The family was far from being among the mortal powers of Nulamia. The Thresends narrowly had the means to maintain a presence in court, and had enough friends in the vampire nobility to keep their blood from being preyed upon. If they wished to maintain what standing they had to keep their wealth concentrated. Nagia's eldest sister, Fahaska, would inherit the bulk of the fortune. Nagia had few expectations. It was her duty to increase the family's wealth by whatever means she could. It was a duty that had always grated. She chafed under the shadow of vampire rule, and so she chose to believe that the toppling of Neferata would be a lethal blow against the power structure of the city. This had been her secret conviction since her adolescence, more than 30 years. She had also known not to breathe a word of her belief to anyone, not once in her life. Yet Vask had come to know. Somehow he had learned of her. She had first learned of him in her dreams. His presence had emerged from every chaotic flow of images, night after night, hunched and hooded, too consistent and clearly defined to be dismissed as her imagination. He spoke words of resistance and hope. One night, he told her another ally would contact her in her waking hours. She treasured that day, more than 10 years past. It lived in her memory with perpetual clarity. It was, she believed, her first real step towards the dreamed-of triumph over the Mortark of Blood. Following her dream, she had gone that morning to the market near Scarab Gate. She had lingered before a silk merchant's stall, feigning interest in robes dyed green and black. After a few minutes there, a voice at her elbow said,
There is purity in such art, but not only there. The words were those Vasque had told her to expect.
Nagia turned. The man who had spoken was dressed as a travelling merchant, his clothing fine but weathered by the road. His face, too, had been worked on by long exposure to wind. Cracked and leathered, it made him look older than he was.
Nagia stepped away from the stall. "You have wares I should see," she said, as Vasque had instructed.
"I bring you more than simple wares," said the merchant, completing the dream refrain. "I bring you wonders."
They left the stall and moved off through the crowd, appearing casual, speaking carefully. At first, Nagia let the merchant do most of the talking, wary of taking the further, irrevocable step of speaking against Neferata, and so becoming an active conspirator. Her reluctance crumbled quickly. If she wished to be more than a dreamer, then she must take the risk. And so, as the crew of dealers and the loud give and take of bartering customers drowned out her voice to any listeners except the man at her side, she said,
"I will do whatever is asked of me."
He nodded, and they walked on, their talk becoming more cautious and more serious. The merchant did not give her his name.
"I do not know yours," he said. "This is how it must be between us. I also do not know what your task will be, nor who will contact you next. It may be me. It may be someone else. I know little more than you do, and that is how our struggle will triumph. Only Vasque knows everything. We cannot betray what we do not know, no matter what is done to us."
The fear of torture and death had kept Nagia silent until this day. Her rebellion had been a fantasy, never realised. And now the merchant made it clear that her fears were justified. Somehow, that justification diminished them. She knew what she was doing. She knew what she was risking. And she was ready. Since that day, she had come to know only fragments of the fight against Neferata. Vasque had spoken to her in her dreams once in every great while, and there had been other encounters with fellow conspirators. These had come in the markets, on the grand boulevards, and in the chapels of Nulamia. She had been tasked with observing what went on in court. She had never been asked to take action. Even her observations had been safe. She did not have to go where she should not. She did not have to pry into secrets. Being present in court and relaying what she saw was enough. That was why, this night, at the celebration of the triumph at Nell, she had initially been sure she was still safe. She had never really done anything to put herself in danger. Even if one of her clandestine meetings had been overheard, what would Neferata's spies know? That she traded in court gossip? It would have been unusual, perhaps even suspicious, if she did not do so. She had nothing to fear. Her conduct was beyond reproach. Though she conspired against Neferata, she did so primarily in her heart. She had taken no action that would be out of the ordinary for a loyal subject. Nagia had told herself this many times. She believed it. Too many years had passed for it not to be true. Neferata did not know a viper moved through her court. The conviction of invisibility made Nagia feel powerful. When Neferata began to speak of treachery, Nagia was unconcerned. She had expected this. It was inevitable in the wake of Vasque's failed attack. Nagia was safe, though. Neferata had no reason to look her way. It was the end of Neferata's address to her enemies that caused her first prickle of unease.
"You are silent, but we will hear you. They will hear you."
It was as if Neferata had been speaking directly to Nagia.
"Of course it seems like that,"
she thought, pushing back against anxiety.
"The words were chosen to have that effect on anyone with a secret."
She dismissed the threat.
"I am stronger than your games."
She kept a look of worship and awe on her face. It was a mask perfected over a lifetime. She put the presence of the Black Knights down to more theatre. They added the menace of immediate retribution to Neferata's words. But they could not hurt what they could not find. The threat delivered, Neferata gave the signal for the revels to resume. The musicians began a bass dance. Nagia put aside Neferata's speech for later contemplation and concentrated instead on her task. Her duty to Vask had not ended. If anything, what she did was more important than ever after the defeat at Nell. Neferata's speech and her demeanour was something for Nagia to pass on. This was a night to be sharp in her observations. She danced with Lord Arkale. He was a venerable vampire noble. He had joined the ranks of the dead in his dignified prime, and he carried himself with self-conscious pride in his appearance. He was a minor aristocrat, owing fealty to the Lady Arvale, and had fought under the Night Reaper's command at Nell. Nagia congratulated herself on being seen with a vampire whose loyalty, on this night at least, was beyond question. They bowed to each other, and in unison with the other dancers, met in the centre of the floor, palm to palm.
"I have heard of your bravery on the battlefield," Nagia said. "It is an honour to dance with you."
They moved two steps to the left, then the right, and revolved around each other once. Arkale nodded as they repeated the movements. His gesture was sharp, precise, a restrained acknowledgement of the compliment, received with no false humility. He was ostentatious in his lack of ostentation. "It was my privilege to fight for the Queen," he said. Arkale glanced at the Black Knights. His lips narrowed with displeasure.
"You do not appreciate the presence of the Riders of Nell?" said Nagia.
"I do not begrudge our queen any action that she feels is necessary. The traitors must be rooted out. Even so," he said, his nose wrinkling with offended propriety, "I could have wished for tools better suited to the time and place." They withdrew, turned, and came back together again. Nagia saw Arkale watch one of the knights tread heavily past, boots striking hard on the marble floor. "They belong on the battlefield, not at a ball," Arkale said.
"I belong everywhere my queen directs me."
Nagia had not seen the Hell Knight approach behind Arkale. The vampire jerked, startled. The Hell Knight's name had already become known throughout the court. It was difficult for Nagia to look at Scarveth Lytesian's skull and keep her hatred from her face.
"You are the real traitor."
He had betrayed all the generations that had come before him and protected a tyrant. Scarveth moved on, keeping to the back of the dancers. Nagia remained partners with Arkale through a few more dances, then excused herself during a break in the music. She strolled over to a gossiping trio of nobles clustered beside a pillar not far from the musicians' gallery.
"I came to attend a triumph," said Lady Seville. "I thought we were here to celebrate, not to subject ourselves to suspicious eyes."
"Oh,"
said Lord Ankervas.
"Do you have something to hide?"
"No,"
Seville sputtered. The vampire glared at the mortal. They were both tall, bald and wrinkled with age. In their finery, they looked like squabbling bedposts.
"Of course I don't. What I meant is that I do not appreciate being made to feel as if I do."
"If we are without guilt, then there is no reason to feel that way,"
Nagia put in, her tone reasonable and mild.
"I think you are deliberately misunderstanding me," said Seville.
"I wonder what they understand,"
said Lady Akansavad. She nodded at a pair of Black Knights moving slowly through the crowd at the end of the hall.
"I keep waiting to see them encircle Drezkem,"
said Ankervas. The others nodded knowingly. Drezkem did not descend from one of the noble houses. His public face was as a merchant, but his primary activity was money lending. He had been practicing his trade for centuries and there were many vampires and mortals in Ulamia who were in his debt, and bitterly so. Seeing him revealed as a traitor would be a welcome spectacle for the crowd. Seville frowned.
Am I wrong? They don't seem to be actually looking at anyone.
They aren't, Nagia agreed.
The riders of Nell turned their heads back and forth as they walked. The movement suggested that they were taking in all of the revelers around them. With skeletons, it was difficult at the best of times to tell where they were looking. But now that Nagia paid attention, she could see a difference between the ways Scarveth and his knights patrolled the hall. Scarveth clearly focused his gaze on one dancer or another. His warriors seemed to look through or beyond the courtiers, if they saw them at all.
They're listening, I think, said Akansavad.
To what?
Ankavas asked.
Our conversations?
If they are, said Seville, they can't be hearing much that's useful to them.
The Black Knights never paused by any one group. They walked at a steady pace. They could only be picking up snatches of exchanges as they passed.
You're right, though,
Ankavas said to Akansavad.
They are listening.
Nagia's mouth went dry. Neferata's threat rose in her thoughts. You are silent, but we will hear you. They will hear you. If the Black Knights were not listening for words, Nagia wondered, what did they expect to hear? She tried to think what other cues might give a precious secret away. Her sense of security vanished. She was terrified she had overlooked something. She became aware that her heart was beating hard. The two riders of Nell paused. They turned her way. Forcing her voice to sound casual, she said,
If they find who they're looking for, so much the better for everyone. They are awkward guests at a celebration.
She nodded to the three nobles and walked away. Nagia strolled towards the other end of the hall as if she were bored with the conversation and looking for more interesting company. The two Black Knights kept pace, walking in parallel with her on the other side of the dancers. Nagia looked around and saw another rider of Nell, motionless, facing her way. Then the warrior began to march slowly and deliberately in her direction. Nagia stopped beside a pillar. She pressed against the side, facing away from the dais. She did not want Neferata to see her. More importantly, she did not want to see Neferata. If she beheld the queen looking at her, she would be lost. She tried to steady her breathing. Her pulse hammered in her ears.
They know, she thought. How? How do they know?
Maybe she was wrong. If the Black Knights knew her secret, why hadn't they seized her? Maybe she was mistaken. Maybe they only seemed to be closing in on her. She had to calm down. She was starting to behave as if she was guilty.
That's what she wants. You're falling into her trap like the greenest fool.
Neferata had declared that traitors were present. She brought in menacing warriors, ones who had been in Vask's confidence. Then all the queen had to do was watch as fear spread and the conspirators revealed themselves. Nagia pushed herself away from the pillar. She smiled at a group of passing revelers.
Take part. Do not attract notice. Walk around the trap.
She took a breath and started to catch up with the chattering group. As she did, a Black Knight walked into view 5 columns down and stopped still, facing the wall on Nagia's left, not looking at her. Nagia froze. She held her breath and her heart battered even harder. The Black Knight turned abruptly and faced her.
They will hear you.
Nagia's heartbeat was betraying her. These creatures could hear her terror. They were tracking her through her secrets. It didn't matter how she behaved. Denials would be worse than useless.
They know. They know. They know.
She gasped, held breath escaping in a ragged stutter. The traitor in her chest hammered against the prison of her ribcage.
Leave! Flee! Get out of here! Now!
The Black Knight strode towards her. The hope tattered and desperate that she could still somehow blend in with the crowd, that she could submerge her fear in the sea of others' passions, pushed her to turn back to the main space of the hall. She would hide in the multitude. She would vanish in the collective anonymity until she could calm herself and be truly invisible again. She would... She rounded the pillar, chasing the hope, and almost ran into four riders of Nell. They were waiting for her, motionless, silent. The wavering threads of darkness surrounding them seemed to reach for her, beckoning her to judgment. Beyond the knights, dancers had faltered in their steps. They were looking her way, curious, nervous, eager to see if and how far they should distance themselves from her. She saw relief in their faces too. Neferata's gaze would not be falling on them tonight. She glanced at the dais. The Mortark was no longer there. Indecision and terror paralysed Nagia. She couldn't even think whether Neferata's absence was a good or evil thing. She looked back at the Black Knights. They said nothing. They were waiting.
Do you want me to confess? Do you think standing before me will be enough to break me?
She wasn't sure that they were wrong. Then terror met defiance, and their fusion gave her the ability to move again. She turned aside from the Black Knights and walked down the row of columns to the main doors of the Great Hall. Her legs felt like rusted iron. She tried to maintain the illusion that all was well. There was nothing to see here. She was tired, that was all. She was retiring, not fleeing. Her departure had nothing to do with the riders of Nell. The Black Knights did not follow her, though they turned as if watching her leave. She looked back. The voids of their eye sockets were a terrible impassivity, and the worst of all promises. She forced herself to breathe evenly.
Calm yourself. Convince them they are wrong.
If her heart slowed and quieted, perhaps the riders would believe she had simply been alarmed by their presence. She was mortal, after all. Death held every terror for her. Two skeleton servants waited at the huge doors. They opened them for her without comment and bowed. There was nothing in their actions. They performed their duty no differently than she had seen them do so 100 times before. If they had thoughts or opinions, they could not be expressed in the faces of bone. But to Nagia, their skulls were the mirrors of the blank judges behind her. Nagia paused at the threshold. She told her legs to move. They refused. The skeletons looked at her, waiting. She looked back again. The full complement of Black Knights had gathered. Scarveth stood slightly to the side. He was watching his warriors rather than Nagia. He did look her way, though, when the others began to move towards her. They took slow, stately steps. They were unhurried. There was no possibility that she would escape them. She would try. Nagia walked through the doorway. She kept up her pretense that much longer. When the skeletons closed the doors behind her, the reverberating boom unleashed her panic. She broke into a run. She lifted the heavy folds of her dress and fled through the corridors of the Palace of Seven Vultures. She flew through uncanny emptiness. There were no courtiers to be seen, and if there were servants or guards about, she did not see them. Cold stone bore witness to her flight. Shadows pooling beyond the light of torches were knowing. There were eyes there, she was sure, eyes and worse. She stuck to the centre of the passages, weaving from light to light until she passed through the gates of the palace and onto the pathway of punishment. Now, in the vastness of the night, she hoped to make friends with the dark. She needed it to conceal her. She could not hide in the Great Hall, but she could in Nalamia. Though Neferata ruled the city, it kept secrets from her. Nagia's allegiance had been one of those secrets until tonight. There were others, somewhere out there were Nagia's comrades in the struggle against the Mortark. She wished she knew who they were. She understood why she must not. She was discovered, but they were safe. She could not betray them. She could not hope for shelter from them. They were concealed from Neferata's eyes, though, at least for now. Hiding was possible. She would find another way to disappear. She must. The pathway of punishment zigzagged down Throne Mount, its boulevards lined with the tortured and the dead, thousands of bodies broken on instruments of agony for the pleasure of the Queen. One of the wheels or stocks or hanging cages might be hers in the near future if the Black Knights caught her. As she reached the first sharp bend in the road, she took one last look at the palace entrance. The Riders of Nell had emerged. Their line advanced slowly, inexorably, to the pathway of punishment. Nagia ran. Fresh terror gave her a burst of energy, and she rushed down Throne Mount. The road was long, though. Three turns later, still some distance from the base of the mount, she was staggering. Her breath rasped painfully. Her heart pounded with renewed frenzy, exhaustion compounding with fear. Her chest felt as if she had been kicked by a horse. She kept looking back, and a frail thread of hope returned to her. There was no sign of the Black Knights. She let herself believe she was putting distance between them and herself. Once she had stumbled to the bottom of Throne Mount, she stayed off the grand boulevards of Nulamia. She stuck to the narrower streets, never staying on a single one for long, taking intersections at random, changing directions for several blocks before resuming her original westward journey. She was soon past the great warehouses and the estates of the wealthiest merchants. The dwellings became humbler, the roads darker. Rows of houses, each containing dozens of apartments, leaned towards each other, their peaked roofs sometimes touching over the middle of the fetid alleys. The further into the poorer districts Nagia went, the thicker the darkness became. Despair wafted down the streets, a visible miasma emanating from people who clung to life because their fear of enslavement after death exceeded the misery of existence. This was a region Nagia had come to know through a sense of necessity. Minor though the Thresens were, they had never known poverty. Their manor house bordered on this quarter, though. In her youth, Nagia had explored the streets, driven by a sense of adventure and curious to gaze upon the poor, whose life was so distant from hers, she thought of them as a different species, creatures almost mythical. Since she had joined Vask's struggle, she had made a more serious effort to learn the dark alleyways and dead ends, thinking of the quarter as a wilderness in which she might, should disaster strike, find concealment. There would be no friends for her here. She knew that. Before tonight, when they saw her, the people had been suspicious of her motives and fearful of how she planned to use them. A noble in flight would be even less likely to engender sympathy. The people would keep their distance, and if the forces of the Queen asked if they had seen her, they would not protect her. As Nagia stumbled through the dimness, she caught glimpses of pinched, narrow, pale faces looking at her through grimy windows. She wanted to shout at them. She wanted to tell them, "I am fighting for you too. Join me. Help me." They would not believe her. They were too much enslaved by their fear of Neferata. She placed her hopes in the architecture of the quarter, in its squalor, in its miserable density that turned it into a maze. Lives vanished here. Souls vanished here. Hope vanished here. Surely she could too. She was not thinking beyond the next few hours. If she survived them, then she would consider what to do next. She had the thought of fleeing to Angaria. The plan was unformed, a fantasy. She knew nothing of the Empire, except that it was the enemy of Neferatia. That was enough for now. All she needed was a vague dream of escape to keep her going. She took the roads at random, choosing the darkest and bleakest. She was trying to become lost. In the logic of her terror, she felt that if she didn't know where she was, neither would the Black Knights. The stench of the quarter was suffocating, and she had to breathe through her mouth. Sewage collected on the sides of the streets. Bodies slumped in corners, forgotten and unmourned, devoured by rats, swarmed by flies. The clammy, buzzing night wrapped around her, and Nagia felt truly invisible. She turned a corner. The silhouette of a Black Knight waited for her at the other end of the alley. With a sob, Nagia spun and ran back the way she had come. She paused at the next intersection, looking down every path. The way to her right was lost in profound darkness. Even so, she caught a glimpse of a cape flapping and heard the scrape of a boot on stone. She fled, hope disappearing. She chased the dark, but it was no longer an ally. With every turn, she felt the noose drawing tighter. She was running in smaller and smaller circles. Her routes of flight were disappearing. And then, at last, they were all gone. She worked her way by touch through a passage between two blank walls. It was so narrow the buildings on both sides brushed her shoulders. Human debris squelched beneath her feet. She came out of the alleyway into a tiny courtyard. A disused well crumbled at its centre, clogged with rubble, leaking filthy water over the cobblestones. Faint illumination came from lantern light in the windows of the surrounding buildings. It washed over the courtyard like a shroud. There was no way out. Heavy footsteps rang in the passageway. Nagia faced the narrow line of deeper blackness and retreated until her back was against a wall. One by one, the riders of Nell entered the courtyard. The air was still, yet their cloaks billowed slowly as if caught in a sluggish, ethereal wind. They paused, their heads turning back and forth. Nagia shrank against the wall. She held her breath. She willed herself to vanish. Her heartbeat thundered, and the black knights closed in around her. Their movements were so unhurried and majestic, it was as if time slowed down in their presence. As they drew near, Nagia felt as if she were submerged in water, her own movements held by the lethargy of nightmare. She could not have run, even if there was any way of getting through the line of riders. A cloud of darkness had arrived with the black knights. It spread over the courtyard, blotting out the light from the windows. Nagia could still see, though. A sepulchral glow emanated from the bones of the warriors. Scarveth entered the courtyard shortly after the other riders. He stopped beside the ruined well, watching his warriors. The black knight directly before Nagia stepped forwards and pressed the tip of a sword against her throat. A woman's voice, grating and echoing, issued from the skull.
"Did you think you could hide? Craven traitor, you cannot conceal the secrets of your heart from us. How did you believe you could run?"
Nagia stared into the empty eye sockets. She saw the shallowness of her dreams of rebellion and subterfuge. Before that darkness, they turned brittle, cracked, and fell to dust. Her breath came in gulping, fearful gasps. Then a voice even more awful than the face of death said, "I will deal with her." The Black Knight sheathed her sword. She stepped away from Nagia. She and her comrades bowed before Neferata. Nagia had not seen the queen arrive. She was simply present. The city was hers. Nagia cursed herself for ever believing otherwise. The queen could be anywhere. Her rule was everywhere. Neferata clasped Nagia by the throat. Her grasp was effortless, smooth, cold and unbreakable. Her lips parted, revealing her fangs. "Do you wish to be a spy?" she said. "Do you wish to be the unseen traitor? Do you wish to be the worm that destroys from within? Then I will grant your wishes." She lifted Nagia from the ground. Nagia squirmed, her feet kicked in the air. She tried to shake her head to engage in one last act of denial. Neferata held her fast and bent her head back, exposing her neck. "Your dreams have always been a delusion," she said. "Your will is and always has been irrelevant. You are Nulamian, and so you belong to me." Nagia screamed once as the queen's fangs sank into her flesh. Though she could no longer cry out after that, there was no mercy as Neferata fed. When she was done, Neferata dropped the insensible Nagia. When the woman regained consciousness, she would have no will except what Neferata chose for her. The dark cloud swirled over the courtyard, concealing those present from curious eyes.
You were not seen to pursue her?
Neferata asked Vissia.
No, my queen. We herded her through her panic.
Then you have done well.
Her departure from the Great Hall was certainly noticed,
said Scarveth.
And so will her return be, said Neferata. Her flight will be read as fear and create more uncertainty. The other traitor remains at the dance.
Two hearts had been beating with guilt at the revel. The one belonging to Lord Carlinth had been ignored.
Before dawn, seize Carlinth. Execute him at the top of the pathway of punishment. Mark the end of the celebration with his destruction. Nagia Thresend will become a mere distraction. Let the conspirators think that we think we have found all that we sought.
And we will allow the Thresend traitor her liberty for now.
Neferata bent down to examine her prone thrall.
Yes. We will wait for her to take us to Vask.
The change in troop deployment happened immediately after the Battle of Nell. Velazza didn't realize its full extent at first. She witnessed the sudden spike in the mobilization as the marches through the center of Mausolea became an unceasing river of warriors. Day and night, the civilian population fled to the side streets as the great boulevards rang with the thunder of thousands of boots and the creaking grind of hundreds of supply carts. Brayherd's bellows rattled the shutters of windows, and the tall silhouettes of siege towers loomed over the habitations. The deafening beat of war drums reached across the city. The incinerating beam that raged from Skaldagar Bastion blazed with ever greater fury. The Prince of Angaria had responded to defeat with a tidal wave of anger. Velazza had expected he would. For a few days, she could even look upon the scale of the marches as a sign of just how complete the rout must have been.
He will wait no longer. He will throw himself into war, whether he is ready or not.
That was exactly what Neferata wanted. She wanted Graunos's injured pride to goad him into an attack governed by anger instead of strategy. But as the days passed and the size of the Angarian march only grew, Velazza began to worry. Past a certain size of army, she wondered how much it would matter what thought there was behind it. What would be worse, though, was thought and rage working together. From her perspective on the streets of Mausolea, she could not tell if that was happening or not. It was Gesser who witnessed the ill omens. She spoke of them on the fourth night of the march, when she returned from her flights to the west, and Neferata's spies gathered in their cellar.
I didn't comprehend the full import of what I was seeing until I was close to Mausolea again,
Gesser told them.
I flew around the city to be sure. Graunos is no longer sending troops to the south.
They are still leaving by the south gate,
Velazza pointed out.
Only to relieve congestion to the west. Once they are outside Mausolea's walls, they rejoin the rest of the army. Graunos is throwing his entire strength towards Neferatia.
Nighthall Pass is close to him. What good is that size of army if he cannot effectively get it into Neferatia?
Tavencia asked.
Perhaps he has found another way in,
said Epicente.
One unknown to us?
Gesser sounded doubtful.
We cannot rule out the possibility, unlikely though it is,
Velazza said.
Even granting that,
said Epicente.
Dismissing the threat of the anvils of the Heldenhammer is foolish. We expected the possibility of a rash act, said Gesser. Perhaps this is it.
She did not sound happy with her own surmise.
Turning away from one threat to aim all his wrath at the source of a recent defeat, said Velazza.
That sounds very much like what we had hoped would be the result of the Battle of Nell.
Too much like it,
Epikente said gloomily. Velazza nodded. I think you're right. She wished otherwise. This is so evidently the mistake we have been looking for that it must be something else.
I have listened to the conversations of the Bloodbound, said Epikente.
She could come very close to the enemy without ever being noticed.
They are angry, but confident. Morale is high. If there is any desperation in the Bastion, it has not reached the troops on the ground. If anything, they are straining at the bit. They want vengeance for Nighthall Pass and Nell, and they are sure they will get it.
Velazza grimaced. This Prince of Khorne refuses to be goaded.
Let us imagine what he is doing then, said Tavencia.
She looked at the map of Angaria on the table they stood around.
If what appears to be a mistake is not one, then we must look to the south.
Yes, said Velazza. Has Graunos withdrawn any forces from the southern gate?
I don't think so, said Gessa. No more are heading in that direction, but none, as far as I can tell, are returning.
Then Graunos has not decided the Stormcast Eternals are harmless.
The simplest explanation is that he has reinforced the south enough to hold back the anvils of the Heldenhammer,
said Epikente,
and that he is determined to crush one foe before the other. Neferatia has always been his goal and is the greater threat, so he will attack us first.
That would be a tactically sound decision, Velazza agreed. He is the one with the most to lose in having war occur on two fronts. The problem is that there still does not seem to be a way for him to attack Neferatia.
A bluff,
Gessa whispered, sounding impressed in spite of herself. It could be. Velazza wanted to be wrong. A massive thrust towards the west to draw all attention from the south.
Implying he knows we're here, said Tavencia.
He has to assume Neferata's eyes are on him. She presumes the same.
Graunos misdirects us and plans to strike the anvils of the Heldenhammer first, said Gessa.
And conceals his fist. Velazza did not believe the forces already at Angaria's southern gate would be enough to prevail over Sigmar's warriors. There was a pause. The spies looked at each other. We are agreed, then, in our interpretation of what we have observed.
We are,
said Epikente. The others nodded. Velazza moved to the concealed chamber to bleed another prisoner and convey what she and her sisters had seen and concluded to Neferata. When she had finished speaking to the shape that had formed in the blood mist, the queen said, I have a new task for your group.
Observation will no longer suffice. It is time for you to take direct action. Let disruption be your watchword. Make Graunos feel my hand in the heart of his realm. Disturb his thoughts and plans.
Disruption, Velazza. Disruption. When war is inevitable, it is not always advisable to strike first. It may be advantageous to lure the enemy into acting first and doing so against their own interests. What is an eternal truth is that the foe is making similar calculations. Thus, the battle rages long before the armies meet on the field. Neferata, the Invisible Flames. Chapter 8.
Nagia woke. She was in her bed in the Thresend Manor. She sat up, surrounded by morning light. She had not pulled the bed curtains before falling asleep,
and she blinked against the brightness. The house was silent. She had all the East Wing's upper floor for her private use, and the servants knew not to disturb her when she slept. She could not remember returning home last night, and she could recall only portions of the celebration at the palace. She had danced with Lord Arkale. There had been conversations and gossip. Neferata's chilling speech was clear in Nagia's memory, and she remembered the Riders of Nell too. She had become nervous at some point and had decided to leave. But there her recall began to fail. Everything became vague. Somehow she had made it to her bed before passing out. There had been nightmares too. They were dim things now, filled with hints of pursuit, smothering and pain. She wondered how much she had had to drink at the revel. She did not feel hungover, though. There was a slight muzziness in her head, but the light, now that she was fully awake, did not hurt her eyes. The anxiety of the night before had passed. Neferata had threatened her enemies with doom, but she had not seen into Nagia's heart. The secrets were safe. Nagia was safe. She felt surer of purpose than ever before, her way forward absolutely clear. Nagia dressed hurriedly and left the house. She had to get to the palace. She had to be seen. She wanted to erase any doubts about her that might be lingering in the minds of others. If, as she thought, she had departed the ball dramatically, it was important to restore normality. She did not want anyone, especially Neferata, to think she was hiding. She made her way down the great boulevard of the Queen's Road and up the pathway of punishment. Where the pathway reached the top of Throne Mount, a crowd had gathered. People stood around a bifurcated torture device. Two iron poles pointed upward in opposing diagonals. Manacles held the arms and legs of the victim to the shafts. A clockwork mechanism at the base had slowly, hour by hour, pushed the poles away from each other until the body of the condemned had been ripped apart. All that remained was a bloody, shredded mass dangling from the two halves. Nagia pushed her way to the front of the crowd and stared at the ruin of flesh and torn cloth.
"Oh, there you are!" Lady Seville was at Nagia's right elbow. "I was wondering where you'd run off to."
"I wasn't feeling well."
"That's the problem with being mortal. You should think more about my offer."
Seville had invited Nagia to become her thrall for the first time 3 years ago. She renewed the invitation regularly.
"Perhaps," Nagia said absently.
She gestured at the corpse. "Who was it?" The skull and face had been separated from each other. The skull hung, wet and gleaming, on the left. The face dangled on the right, limp, a clump of red rags.
"Lord Carlinth," Seville breathed. "Imagine! I've never seen him put a foot wrong, whether he was dancing or paying court."
"Maybe that in itself should have made us suspicious."
"Very true, very true."
Seville shook her head in a display of performative sorrow that didn't even begin to disguise her glee.
"What happened?" Nagia asked. "It was as the ball was breaking up," Seville said. "The Riders of Nell had left just after you did."
She lowered her voice to a stage whisper.
"I don't mind telling you, dear, that I was worried they were going after you."
Nagia smiled brightly. "Yet here I am."
Seville laughed. "And I couldn't be more pleased."
"Thank you."
Nagia had her doubts. The only thing that would have been more exciting for Seville than the execution of a fellow noble would have been two executions.
"At any rate," Seville continued, "the Riders came back, and they seized Carlinth as we were leaving. He protested, of course. They never said anything, just dragged him from the palace and chained him to the death engine."
"Did it take long?"
"You only just missed the end. His final scream was less than an hour ago. It was a spectacle, my dear. A fine warning."
She nodded in satisfaction.
A warning indeed, Nagia agreed.
We must hope that it is heeded,
Seville said piously.
Oh, I don't know. I would prefer to see the traitor's court.
Nagia spoke with confidence. She had escaped suspicion last night under the very eyes of Neferata. She had been nervous in the past every time she had taken the most insignificant step of rebellion. That anxiety was gone now. She was sure she would never be caught.
I think that would be preferable to simply frightening them into inaction. Don't you?
Oh, of course, of course.
Nagia stayed a few minutes longer before the remains of Lord Carlinth. She wondered if, even now, there were other allies of Vask who were being rounded up. She hoped not. But if they were, that made her commitment to the cause all the more important. Fueled by determination, she entered the palace and did her rounds, meeting with her usual circles of fellow courtiers. The talk was all about Carlinth, though there was curiosity, too, about Nagia's sudden exit the night before. She explained that she had taken ill.
The thought of such treachery in our numbers could make anyone take a bad turn,
said Lord Halfrank, another mortal. His complexion was so sallow, he appeared to be in perpetual ill health. It was an impression he never took pains to discourage. Nagia thanked him. As the day wore on, her lie gradually turned into truth. She did feel unwell. She was hungry and thirsty, but anything she tried to eat or drink made her stomach convulse. Cramps tightened her guts. As evening approached and she made her way back to the manor, she could barely walk upright. She staggered in through the main doors and leaned against the wall in the entrance hall. She waved away the doorman who came to help her. One of her maidservants appeared at the landing of the main staircase. She ran down to Nagia, looking worried.
"I will fetch Lord Thresand," she said.
"No," Nagia snapped. "Let my father be."
She reached the foot of the stairs, grasped the banister, and began to haul herself up.
"I don't want to see anyone."
"But my lady..."
"I want to be alone. I want everyone off the top floor. Do you understand?"
The maid nodded, though it was clear she didn't understand. Neither did Nagia. She didn't know why she had given the orders. There was no reason for them. She was having trouble thinking clearly. All she knew was that she had a ferocious impulse to be by herself. The instinct was too strong to be fought. She climbed the stairs, past ancestral portraits so dirtied by centuries of smoke from candles and torches that they were no more than murky silhouettes. The stairs seemed endless, her chambers suddenly on a mountain's peak. She was gasping and retching by the time she had last reached the top floor. She weaved back and forth, bent double, clutching her stomach. She felt as if vicious creatures were chewing their way out from her insides. She would have screamed if her jaw hadn't been clenched tight. Her breath hissed out from between her teeth. She stumbled through the door of her bedchamber and fell to her knees, squeezing her eyes shut as the pain spiked again. When she opened them, she saw that she was not alone. A woman she had never seen before stood next to the open window. Her wings were draped around her like a cloak. She had dark skin and a noble bearing. Nagia did not know what house she might be from, but from the way the vampire gazed at her, Nagia sensed that she stood far above the Thresands. She held one end of a chain. The other end was around the iron collar of a man who was blindfolded and gagged. Nagia didn't know who he was either. She guessed he was one of the countless anonymous souls who made up Nulamia's underclass.
"Who are you?"
Nagia asked, squeezing her arms tightly around her agonized stomach.
"My name is Skintha,"
the woman said. She stepped closer, yanking the chain and forcing the man to crawl forwards.
"Why are you here?"
Skintha looked down at her contemptuously.
Because you need to feed, and you are evidently too stupid to understand what your body cries out for.
She brought the man to within a foot of Nagia. Then she removed his collar and with a quick slash of her clawed fingers tore open his neck. Blood spurted onto the floor, a glistening invitation. Nagia's hunger launched her forwards. She wrapped her hands around the man's neck and lowered her head to the wound. She drank the blood in greedy mouthfuls. She was drinking pleasure itself and life itself. Her pain vanished, driven out by a wave of ecstasy. Her body shuddered so violently she almost lost her grip on the man's neck. She clutched him even more tightly and buried her face in the wound. She drank, and strength returned to her limbs. She drank and lost herself in the glory of blood. Skintha laughed. "You do not even know what you are," she taunted. "Yet you revel in what you have become." Nagia barely heard her. She did not understand what Skintha meant, and she didn't care. She drank until, sated, she fell unconscious. When she woke the next morning, the previous evening and night had faded from her memory. It worried her that she seemed to be engaging in drunken excesses. Now, more than ever, she had to be careful. She promised herself to observe more